This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello, listener. Dahlia Lithwick here, host of Amicus, that's Slate's podcast on the courts and the law and democracy and the rule of law. This May, our team will be publishing a special project that we are calling How Originalism Ate the Law. This neutral and academic-sounding methodology of looking at the law is, in fact, anything but neutral. Originalism is to the conservative legal movement what peanut butter is to jelly. As we're going to show you over the course of this project, originalism has been both cover and calling for conservative justices and judges to radically overhaul the lives of millions of Americans. And while they claim to be the apolitical interpreters of the Constitution and its authors' intents, they have overturned Roe, radically expanded gun rights, and eviscerated voting rights. Across Slate.com and the Amicus podcast, we're going to be tackling questions like, where did originalism come from? Why has it taken over? Are progressive originalists really a thing? And am I allowed to have an opinion on originalism? Spoiler, the answer to that last question, you are. To celebrate the launch of this big project, we are running a special two-week-long free trial of Slate Plus on Apple Podcasts. As a member, you'll get exclusive episodes from How Originalism Ate the Law, plus ad-free listening to all of your favorite Slate podcasts. Join now by clicking Try Free at the top of the Amicus show page or visit slate.com/amicusplus to get access wherever you listen.
On Death, Sex, and Money, we feature interviews with you, our community of listeners, getting honest about uncomfortable things.
I developed an illness where it isn't safe for me to drive. A friend once said to me, sex is like air. You don't think about it until you're not getting enough. This is a similar sort of thing if you just replace sex with driving.
Listen to Death, Sex, and Money wherever you get podcasts.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Welcome to the XX Gabfest for Thursday, October 6th, the Embarrassment of Bitches edition. I'm Hannah Rosen, a host of NPR's Invisibilia. I'm joined in New York by Noreen Malone of New York Magazine. Hi, Noreen.
Hi, I'm lonely here in the studio today.
Yes, there is no June. And to fill the shoes of the larger-than-life June, we will have three guests, because it takes three people to make one June, a series of guests, one for each topic. So let's jump in. Our topics today are, first, Trump threatens to bring up Hillary's marriage as a campaign issue. We discuss with Slate political analyst Jamelle Bouie. Second, the sex ed queens of YouTube. We discuss with New York Times writer Amanda Hess. And finally, Fleabag, a new Amazon series starring a highly unlikable female protagonist. We talk about that with The New Yorker's Emily Nussbaum. For our Slate Plus segment this week, as part of Slate's 20th anniversary celebrations, we at the XX Gabfest are going to talk about and nominate our favorite segments of all time. Our peers at Hang Up and Listen and the Culture Gabfest and the Political Gabfest also revisited their favorite moments. You can listen to the full show and get bonus segments by joining Slate Plus at slate.com/xx. This month, we're offering a very special deal, 30% off annual membership. Sign up and get a full year of Slate Plus for just $35 at slate.com/xx. All right, our first topic, Trump and Hillary. Last week, Trump threatened to bring up the Clinton marriage issue and in so doing brought up the Clinton marriage issue. Here's his exact quote to The New York Times. He says, Hillary Clinton was married to the single greatest abuser of women in the history of politics. Hillary was an enabler and she attacked the women who Bill Clinton mistreated afterwards. I think it's a serious problem for them and it's something that I'm considering talking about more in the near future. Today with us is Jamelle Bouie, Slate's chief political correspondent, to discuss this issue. Hi, Jamelle.
Hello.
So I feel like we could totally dismiss this, except that feminists have raised this issue as well. So it's not completely dismissible. But maybe what we'll do is break it down. So the single greatest abuser, that's obviously an exaggeration, right? Like, we can dismiss the single greatest abuser.
I think I can imagine greater abusers in the world. I mean, you know, it might be tough.
In the history of politics. I mean, like, Thomas Jefferson is in the history of politics. So,
right, right.
You know.
There have to be some British kings or whatever, too.
Yeah. So we can dismiss that one. Let's break down the things that we need to discuss. First, is it legitimate to talk about the 90s issues at all? Like, are they relevant to this conversation? Is it legitimate for Trump himself to bring it up? Let's start there. Let's start there. Jamel, what do you think? Is this legitimate at all? Like, is this a legitimate issue in a presidential, race?
You know, I think it's... I have a pretty broad sense of what counts as a legitimate issue to bring up in a presidential race. I just find it odd because it's the classic example of throwing stones in the glass house, right? Donald Trump is notorious over a long career in public life as a celebrity, as a real estate mogul, for being, the nicest way you could put it is extremely dismissive towards women. In terms of relationships with women, in terms of rhetoric about women, Donald Trump has been very bad. Big league, you might even say.
Big league.
And it's odd to me that Trump would attempt to make Bill Clinton's infidelities and Bill Clinton's actions a subject of the election conversation when the list of women for whom Trump has either cheated on, that he was married to, insulted, disparaged, kind of just goes on and on. So I understand. I mean, again, I sort of have this very broad sense of what counts as being a legitimate issue in an election, but I just cannot for the life of me understand, other than pure narcissism on Trump's part, why he would bring this up in particular.
Well, and also, even if Donald Trump did not have his own checkered past, women voters, even Republican women voters, do not like to hear women blamed for their husband's misdeeds. There's polling on that. So in addition to it being sort of morally suspect that he's bringing it up, it's just not a smart political tactic, it seems. Like, who's he trying to get on his side? Angry white men? I think he's got them.
Right. The polling shows that blaming Hillary for Bill's affairs totally turns off women.
Right.
Right? This is interesting. So he was asked about his affair with Marla Maples, he says, I don't talk about that. I wasn't president of the United States. I don't talk about it. Now, of course, Bill wasn't president either, right? Most of what happened with Bill is when he was running for president, exactly like Trump. But what about this? So did you guys, by any chance, I mean, am I not allowed to bring up whether the Hillary enabler question and whether that's legitimate? Do you think that's a separate question than the Bill question?
I mean, they're related, obviously. It does seem like I think there are degrees of it, right? So Juanita Broderick thinks that Hillary Clinton made a threatening comment to her that was something like, thank you for your support. And Juanita assumed that meant thank you for your silence. But that seems to me to be an overreading of that. On the other hand, there are plenty of people who have talked about during the Jennifer Flowers affair that Hillary was sort of complicit in getting this whole narrative going that Jennifer Flowers was a bimbo and that Hillary was sort of, anything for the cause, even if it meant covering up her husband's infidelities.
You know, the most enlightening story I've read about this is a 1992 story by Gail Sheehy in Vanity Fair. This seemed to be in an era when Hillary was much more open to the press, like wasn't as kind of deflecting. And so she kind of rode around with her in her plane and watched her deal with the Jennifer Flowers affair in real time. And it's kind of a painful story to read. I mean, she basically kind of sidesteps the real issue, like the emotional issue, and sort of jumps right into political management mode, like right there in real time. She says, like, it was in a nondescript motel where she had 20 minutes of downtime that she flipped on the TV, heard the Jennifer Flowers CNN tapes of she and Bill talking, and Now, of course, there's a reporter in the room, so who knows what Hillary was actually feeling. But this is a view of Hillary that you never, ever get anymore. I mean, this close up. And they're together in the hotel room, she and the reporter. And then immediately after, let's get Bill on the phone. Hillary coolly directed her campaign manager, Mintz, who was himself fighting back tears. And he said... And then Bill says, everybody knows you can be paid to do anything. And then Hillary said, everybody doesn't know that. They're going to be thinking, why were you even talking to this person? Which, I mean, that is such an interesting exchange. It's like, is that enabling? Not really. I mean, I don't know what to make of all that. Like, I don't know what to make of the fact that the sort of women became political inconveniences. Like, maybe that's the most you can expect of a wife. Like, I don't know, you know? I don't know.
Yeah. That's what's tricky about this to me. And I was a kid during the Clinton impeachment, during Jennifer Flowers, during Monica Lewinsky, during all of this. So my memory, I don't really have memories of this so much as just like reading back on it as someone who didn't experience it. But I'm sort of at a loss for what Hillary Clinton was supposed to do.
Right.
It's not, right. There's no real template for my husband's a president of the United States and is cheating on me, and this is a national political scandal. And so I tend to have a very wide amount of sympathy for really anyone who would be in that situation. Hillary Clinton, if it were Laura Bush, I would feel similarly.
Well, and so Hillary Clinton has sort of gotten the best possible outcome out of that, right? It's, 15 or 20 years later, and here she is running for president. She's lived several lives since then. She's been a senator. She's been the Secretary of State. She's become a feminist hero. So how is she supposed to deal with that? That ancient
What do you
history?
Mean? Like, how is she supposed to deal
with
that?
Yeah, like, what's
history?
If you were a Hillary Clinton advisor, what would you tell her? Because it's going to come. I mean, Donald Trump did his coy little I'm not going to bring it up thing in the debate, but it's on the table now. She's going to have to address it at some point head on. How does she do that? What's her line?
So her line has consistently been, or her people's line has consistently been, that's in the past. You mm-hmm. know, that doesn't mean anything, and that's in the past. And I suppose they're doing they're thinking what you just said, which is that people don't respond to this. Like, if what's at stake here is married white women who tend to traditionally vote Republican, that's right, Jamel, right? It is married suburban
right.
white women who right. are the people who we are trying to get here. Maybe they're thinking, well, married suburban white women are going to be thinking, it's never the wife's fault. And also, we'll sort of rally to her side. I remember when I wrote about this, the kind of Hillary haters, how they also thought that this was toxic because it immediately brings people to her side. And even more, they'll think, well, they're still together, Like,
yeah.
She stayed with her husband. Like, they're still together. There's clearly some sort of connection. She must have known what she was doing. Like, this whole time, there was a bond between them and they stayed together. I mean, this is a lot of, like, psychobabbling, but I'm just saying this is, like, what? If you're going to play strategically this out, like, the way you strategically play this out is that the people on Trump's side who are pushing him to do this are Hillary conspiracy people, right? It's like Roger Stone. It's people who write Hillary-hating books. And so they're in that sort of universe of people who think that this is, like endlessly damning in the way of the 60s culture wars. That's who's advising Trump. But a kind of, a reasonable Republican pollster would not advise him to use this tactic.
Right. That's what's sort of weird about all of this, because it's very clear that Trump is swimming in the conspiratorial fever swamps where you're right, that people believe that the Clintons are only married for crass political reasons, that there's all sorts of infidelity happening in this relationship on Hillary's part as well as on Bill's part. That this is a sham marriage. And given what we know about Trump as someone who insulates himself, given what we know about presidential campaigns, where it's very easy to become insulated even if you're trying not to be, it does seem like that, however Clinton answers, if Trump brings it up, he'll be taken aback by it because he just will have not thought that, there's an answer to this that is completely normal and reasonable, which in my head probably sounds something like, listen, our marriage is litigated in front of the entire country. We went through a lot of hard times. We worked on it. And I love my husband very much. And I don't think this is a place to discuss that. Let's talk about the issues. Boom, it's done. And I think your casual, typical viewer will hear this. We'll hear Trump or Trump surrogates attempt to make an issue out of the Clinton, Bill Clinton infidelities, will be turned away. It's worth noting, right, that in 1998, Democrats ended up picking up seats in Congress, in part because voters were disgusted with Republican conduct with regards to impeachment. There has been no political upside for playing this up for Republicans. So I'm sort of it's indicative of the kind of environment that Trump is in, that anyone in that campaign would think that this was a good idea.
Jamal, do you think there's been a conversation in the Trump camp about how he should deal with his own infidelities, his documented infidelities, or is he totally shooting from the hip here?
I'm sure there's been a conversation about it among Trump advisors. Whether or not Trump cares what they have to say is a separate question. My hunch is that no matter what Giuliani or Christie or whomever has told him, he is just going to respond how he's going to respond. And so far what that means is just essentially denying that it even matters. I mean, I've noted before that one of the hallmarks of Trump's campaign seems to be this constant projection that things that are demonstrably true of Trump, he accuses his opponents of doing. And this, it's very much the case here. So Trump is a serial adulterer, as is Giuliani. As is Newt Gingrich, as is kind of a good chunk of that brain trust, serial adulterers.
It's what brings them together.
Right. It's a commonality. And they're accusing Clinton of being complicit in infidelity, of being essentially a bad, unqualified to lead the country because her husband cheated on her. And yeah, and Trump's going to go that direction. And the New York Times recently pressed him on it, and he was like, I just don't talk about it.
Yeah.
So that's the approach they're going to take.
Well, and he in the past has said things about Hillary Clinton, like on Twitter a few years ago, he said, well, she couldn't satisfy her husband. What makes America think it could satisfy her? Like, he's speaking about it in the crudest possible terms. We just keep circling back to this point of this amazing double standard that he's constructed. But that really is the essential thing that's going on here. Is there any sense that this will matter to his base, that there is any way that he could talk about infidelity that would get them angry or?
I think his base, it's the cover-up aspect more than the sexual infidelity aspect that he's tapping into. It's the sense that the Clintons cover for each other, and that they will stop at nothing to cover for each other, and that they have sort of dead bodies in their wake. Like, that's the vibe of the Clintons that he's trying to evoke, or that, David Bossie and Roger Stone, like, that's the way that they see. Like, the co-conspirator element of the Clintons is what he's tapping into.
That makes sense.
Jamal, I liked your formulation. I wonder if she'll ever say that. I thought that was a really good formulation, actually. I love my husband. It's been litigated publicly. We're over it. We're old now,
yeah.
Basically,
No, I think my hunch is that Clinton will say some version of that. I think it'll work. I mean, the Republican base, obviously, I think, loves what Trump is doing. As you said, Hannah, there is a real belief that the Clintons, that there are bodies around the Clintons, that the Clintons are responsible for murdering lots of people.
Spiritually, yes.
Not just Vince Foster. I mean, there's a whole Clinton conspiracy about how they were running drugs at the Little Rock Airport. I mean, there's a lot of stuff. I think much of Trump's campaign is basically this primal scream against the Clintons that the right-wing base has wanted. And so they're going to be satisfied by whatever Trump says. But I think your typical voter who may not like Hillary Clinton, who may think she's untrustworthy or has some sense about her, is also not going to be like, this woman is, has a sham marriage. I think people generally don't like to speculate about what's going on in people's marriages, or at least not coming to any huge judgments about it, because people's marriages are personal and it's hard to know. It's impossible to know from the outside what really is going on. And especially with Bill and Hillary Clinton, I sort of think that precisely because of the impeachment, precisely because we've been watching this couple for decades now, it'll be very easy for Clinton just to say, listen, our marriage has gone through some rough spots, just like many Americans have, and we worked on it. And you could probably make that, turn that into some hit on Donald Trump if you wanted to, if you're going to really go that route. But it's, again, often this year I've looked at Donald Trump's rhetorical strategy and been kind of baffled by the decision, given how much of his own history and past is open to the same kinds of accusations.
Yeah, I have to say, I watched the 1992 video, the 60 Minutes interview about Jennifer Flowers, and they did say that, marriages are private, it's nobody's business, we've done it. It seems so much more believable now at their age. Like, that same line just seems to hold so much more true than it did back then when it sort of felt like a line. But I feel like now it would work perfectly. Jamel, thank you so much for joining us in this conversation. It's Jamel Bowie, chief political correspondent for Slate.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks, Jamel.
Next, we're going to talk about the sex ed queens of YouTube. But before we do that, let's hear from our first sponsor. Let's move on to our next topic, the sex ed queens of YouTube. In the New York Times this week, Amanda Hess profiles this generation's Dr. Ruths, a group of internet sex gurus who, she writes, offer sex ed by and for internet natives. It's personal, energetic, unfiltered, and not entirely fact-checked. So today we have Amanda Hess here with us to talk about the new sex ed queens. Hi, Amanda.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Totally. So I gotta admit that I love these ladies, and I really was wishing that they had been around when I was a kid. That was my basic view of it all. Like, despite all of their flaws and their, like, ridiculousness and their sort of, like, you know, self-absorption, I was like, damn, I wish they'd been around, you know? I would have not had to piece together so much. Anyway, let's talk about them specifically. Like, mention one and just kind of what she's like, just to give people a feel, or two, or whatever, your two favorites or the two that are most vivid to you.
Sure. So there's one, Lacey Green, who is she's the most followed sex educator on YouTube, who does these incredible monologues about sex ed topics. So she did one of her most popular videos is like a bunch of secrets about the vagina, which are really just like fun facts, many of which like I didn't know myself.
Really?
Like, as a 31-year-old woman.
Like what? Like, what's one you didn't know, which you would like to scream in the newsroom where you are?
Well, actually, I mean, one is that she compared a vagina to a sock.
Oh, hi, babes. Here are 10 little-known facts about the almighty vagina. The vagina is like a sock. You can put feet in it. I'm just kidding. Don't put feet in it. Unless... Anyway, the vagina is a pathway of muscles that's flat when there's nothing in it. Also, like a sock, there's a top that stops things from getting lost. Here's my
which was not... an image that I had ever had before, and I guess I had there was a void, if you will, in my brain about how exactly like a vagina expands and contracts or whatever, and so that image was, I think, really helpful for me to understand exactly what is going on down there. A sock with a tiny hole at the end, and she has this very handy Play-Doh model of the female reproductive system that she just sort of like pulls out unannounced, which is very charming. She's great. And another thing that she does that I wasn't able to include in the story is that she has acted as a kind of feminist critic of some of the less savory parts of YouTube. So there's this YouTube prankster, which is another sort of like interesting niche of YouTube and is very male dominated. His name is Sam Pepper, and he was accused, you know, many months ago of sexually harassing women in his stunts, of preying on fans, and she filmed this very heartfelt monologue to her fans who had like come to her wanting to understand like how to grapple with this information. So she is a really interesting and important presence on YouTube. And then another woman who's really awesome is Ariel Scarsella, who does LGBT sex stuff. And she is super performative about it. She started out as a comedian. She was doing, like, what she described to me as, like, lesbian comedy. And she has transitioned more into, like, this educational zone. So one of the recent ones she did that I was skeptical about before I watched it, but I ended up being convinced, was she invited a gay friend, a male friend, over, and they filmed themselves naked looking at each other's bodies. So he showed her his penis, and she showed him her vagina, and it was sort of like their first times being really close to those particular types of genitalia. And, you know, she talked about how in the LGBT community, there's like a lot of stigma, or, you know, people can be like, lesbians act grossed out about penises and gay men act grossed out about vaginas. And so I came away thinking, wow, like, that was a really sort of like provocative stunt, but also I can see like why it was important to do it. So she's doing something else that I think is really interesting.
Amanda, who do you think the audience is for this? Is it like college kids? Is it 12-year-olds?
Yeah, I think even they don't totally know. But my sense is that it ranges from, you know, below the 13 or 14-year-old cutoff that, you know, you're ostensibly supposed to reach in order to even access YouTube, all the way up to sort of like 20s and 30s, particularly as they get a little older. I think their audience is aging a little bit with them. But, you know, I had seen these videos myself before writing this piece. And that's one of the interesting things about them, I think, is that because it's on YouTube and there is so much collaboration between them and other YouTubers, the videos surface in kind of unexpected ways to people who are maybe not even necessarily seeking them out.
What do you mean by that? Like, where do they surface that you wouldn't? You mean just like in
I mean,
the
like
YouTube
I would see them. Yeah. So they YouTube, you know, related videos populate on the side. So if you're watching a video that has something to do with like lesbian identity or whatever, Ariel's videos will populate on the side and you'll, you know, be sort of like pushed over into them. So I have seen them that way. I think just because Lacey Green is such an influential YouTuber, her videos pop up like everywhere.
Can we talk about how they are different from sexperts of the past? One thing that you brought up is that they are proud amateurs. Like Lacey Green, she looks completely normal. Her room looks normal, even if a little bit messy. It just looks like Joe dorm room. And they don't particularly want to sell themselves as experts. They're just like people in the world who have sex and think about it a lot and know how to talk about it. Like, what is their self-conception as teachers?
Yeah, I mean, I think everyone that I spoke with identified themselves as a sex educator with an asterisk, basically. Some of them call themselves peer-to-peer educators, meaning, you know, they're educating people who have like the same literal education level as them or are the same age. Hannah Witten, one of the women I wrote about, identifies as a self-taught expert, and she made it clear to me that she uses the term expert loosely. So it is kind of a provocative thing to say that they're sex educators, because education is a field that is obsessed with credentialing. There is an organization that's been around since the 60s called ASECT, the American Association of Sexuality Educators, Counselors, and Therapists, that certifies sex educators. You need to take a certain load of coursework and to be monitored by professionals and to, you know, adhere to a certain professional code and ethical code, and these people, you know, don't do that. They, and in many cases, you know, they argue that there are real positives to that, that going through a traditional sex ed education teaches you a lot about the clinical side, but maybe not as much about, like, how teenagers feel about exploring their sexuality, like on Tumblr or through YouTube or whatever. So Arielle, I mean, the thing that she told me was that teenagers are coming to the internet to try to figure out how they feel. She feels that they can get information from a textbook, but from her, they're looking for something a little more experiential.
Although, Amanda, you mentioned in your article that occasionally there is some misinformation that's spread, right? Like one of them said, oh, you can tell if someone is a lesbian by the relative length of their ring finger. How common is this sort of, like, you know, lunchroom tall tale?
Yeah. So I spoke to Debbie Herbenik, who is the president of ASECT, that sexuality educators organization. She is also a professor at Indiana University. And she told me, you know, I just asked her, like, what are the pros and cons of this sort of approach? And she said, pro, people listen to them. Con, sometimes the things that they're hearing aren't true. And the way that she put it to me was she would watch the videos, and often she put the figure at like 70%. She would say they get it like 70% right, and then 30% is maybe a little squishier. Hmm. She's seen a lot of information that's just sort of like recirculated through these vlogs and like through search engines and stuff. So information that would come up if you Googled like a certain question that was not true. Depending on the person, there is, you know, a differing commitment to accuracy. Mm-hmm. Again, because it's not, you know, within the realm of like professional sex education, it's kind of a crapshoot. And people are not following any particular guidelines. They're sort of like doing their own thing. So it really depends on who you're watching or what the video is.
One thing I was thinking about is the spirit of the video. Like, it's so, you know, sex is fun and we should all be liberated. Do you feel like that's aspirational? You know, like, is that sort of so people watching is it real? Is that a thing to aspire to? Is that something they're modeling? Like, we should all be free and open about our bodies and, you know, look at each other's penises and vaginas. And it seems like an idyllic kind of liberation model.
Yeah, I mean, it is sort of like sex positive in the most positive way possible. It's a lot of the videos feel very sunny, even mm-hmm. if, you right. know, the topic that they're talking about is quite depressing. There's one video that I talk about that Shannon Boudram made. She's another one of these YouTube sex educators where she's black, and she and a white woman staged a stunt where they walked down the street with hidden cameras and counted how many times they were catcalled by mm-hmm. men, like on a Hollywood street. And her white friend was catcalled many more times than she was, even though both are like these extremely beautiful women. And so the lesson was, you know, there's still something about our beauty norms that is racist. But the way that it came off, it was sort of like two women who were like competing to get more catcalls. It was a very sort of like light and fun way that they approached it, which is very in keeping with this sort of like YouTube aesthetic. But it can be kind of difficult to switch gears into the education part of it. But I will say that, you know, I think one of the reasons that Lacey's videos about Sam Pepper or, you know, another YouTuber who she has dialogued with who had said, like, some ignorant things about slutty women are so refreshing is because they are so low touch compared to some of the other videos. So they feel, you know, you can tell that she's herself like a little depressed and exasperated in these videos, that she even has to like address these things. And I found it like really refreshing to watch them because sex should be fun, but it is not always.
Yeah, I loved her consent video. That's the one I thought was great, like in its balance of education. And it was, she sort of performed like how it would actually work in real life and what are some things that, you know, one would say in the middle and what were some things that one would say that would lead you to think that the person's not into it. And it felt extremely realistic to me, like the most realistic consent talk I've ever heard, for sure.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I mean, it's true. I mean, they're solving a real problem, which is that most of the people who are talking to teenagers about being teenagers and particularly about sex are old, you know?
Right.
And so at 26, like, she has this firm handle on how to talk about this stuff, and she's living it too, and that's really compelling.
Yeah, I mean, getting the language right was like a big deal. Like getting the words right of what actually might be said was like made all the difference in the world.
Right.
Amanda, do they ever address porn as almost a competitor in terms of sex education? I would imagine that a lot of kids who are trying to learn about sex go there as well as to these videos, or maybe instead of those videos. Is there ever a segment that's like, okay, here's what's real about this, here's what's not?
Yeah, this is like a common genre within sex ed YouTube, is porn myths versus reality. And many of the people who I spoke with, you know, brought up porn too. They're sort of situated in this place, I think, where they recognize this problem, which is that young people were not getting the sort of dialogue and conversation that they needed at school or with their parents. And so they were going online and like finding a bunch of porn and really, you know, having that be the main way that they were sort of like interacting with the subject of sex. So, you know, Hannah Witten has, I think, done a lot of good work on this. And importantly, like, they don't stigmatize porn. You know, they're not sort of like moralistic about it, but they are offering this alternative that allows people to sort of view porn with a more sophisticated understanding of what it really is.
Interesting.
Well, Amanda, thank you so much for coming on to talk about your piece. It's called The Sex Ed Queens of YouTube, and it's in the New York Times this week. Thanks.
Thanks, guys.
Bye, Amanda.
Next, we'll talk about Fleabag with The New Yorker's Emily Nussbaum. Before we do that, let's thank our next sponsor. So our next topic is Fleabag, a BBC series created by and starring British playwright and performer Phoebe Waller-Bridge as Fleabag, a single woman living in London and screwing everything up. She's running a failing cafe. She's in a failing relationship. And as Emily Nussbaum, New Yorker critic, wrote, she uses sex as her hard drug. So today we have Emily on our show to discuss Fleabag with us. Hi, Emily.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Okay. So here's the first thing that I wanted to talk about. She's so alone, you know? There's like such an absence of female friendship, or a female friendship in absence. Like, that's something in these bad girl comedies. She's just so by herself, you know?
Well, I feel like that's the subject of the show in a way that becomes, I don't want to give anything away particularly about the plot, but I actually feel like the central subject of the show is not really her sex life, but this issue of female intimacy with relationships
with
between
other women,
competition with other women, and the desperation for a confidant. And one of the most straightforward things about Fleabag is that it's very unlike a lot of the shows that are on the air that are on this subject, that are sort of mumblecore kinds of shows about groups of friends all talking to one another, because it's driven by the fact that she keeps turning to the camera.
So, Noreen, so tell us a little bit about the show. What happens in the show? It's 6 episodes, right?
You can watch it in a week. It follows a woman who's around 30. She is living in London. She owns a cafe that is guinea pig themed, which becomes kind of a big important plot point, actually. She is breaking up with her boyfriend and unbreaking up with her boyfriend, who's kind of I don't know what she's doing with him personally. And she is also sort of navigating her relationship with her sister, who is a type A businesswoman, and her father, who is quite distant but kind, and her stepmother, who is not kind.
I mean, to me, I would just describe the show as it's an incredibly a dark and graphic comedy about a woman who is struggling with her personal life and her relationship with her family. She's very distant from everybody, but she's kind of a compulsive seducer. She's lost a best friend who was her support, and her mother has also died, and she's alone and kind of flipping through the world, sort of dealing with this self-identity that she has as a kind of cynical feminist adventurer, but that she is constantly undermining with her own comments, and that she questions herself, and that over the course of the series ends up being critiqued, but in a very deeply sympathetic way about the position that she's in the world and how hard it is.
So take the cynical feminine adventurer. Sort of what is there's so many shows that sort of embody something and critique that thing at the same time, right? That seems to be a thing for female performers and comedians. What is she playing with there? I mean, in the very first episode, they go to a feminist conference, you know, and there's kind of like empowerment feminist talk about the body, which she and her sister completely subvert from the first second. So like, why punch you in the face that way in the very first episode?
Yeah, I think it's a fantastic scene. It's actually her mother who plays the feminist lecturer in that scene.
Oh, really?
Yeah. But the scene is...
Wait, what's the question? Let's any of us remember exactly the question that they ask from the stage. It's like, how many of you would trade some years of life...
Five years of life
for having the perfect body.
Perfect female body, right.
And she and her sister, hilariously, because they're so at odds, they're completely united in this, and they're the only two women in the room, and they literally not just raise their hands, but like raise their hands all the way to the ceiling and very excitedly. And then they realize nobody else is raising their hands, and she turns to her sister and says, I think I'm a bad feminist. So right from the beginning of the show, it already throws in this very funny kind of self-questioning. You know, I mean, I have to say, I've read that question before, and I think everybody always answers it. Most women answer yes, shockingly. So I actually feel like it was parroting something that's a classic kind of question in, you know, sort of women's magazine feminism conversation that goes on.
It's only 5 years.
And it's bad years of life. Maybe.
I mean, and this thing is like an annual conference, right? Apparently she and her sister sort of drag themselves every year because it's like a family tradition.
Did they say that her father pays for them to go to it?
Yeah, her father seems to be paying for them to go to all kinds of activities together that often have a feminist bent. I really love the relationship between the sisters. And in some ways, that seems like the central love story of the show.
I've described this show to people, and they've been like, ugh, I don't want to watch anti-hero shows, and I don't want to watch shows about like women behaving badly. But it's one of those things where when the show is good, and when it's smart, and when it actually has thoughtful things to say, it's different than just your garden variety, like, you know, lady sledding about town kind of thing. I mean, that's not what this is at all.
Now, can I ask you, why is that? Is that a thing? Sort of why so many bad girl shows, so many bad girl comedies? I mean, she says to her father, I have a horrible feeling. I wrote this down. I'm
a greedy,
selfish, apathetic, cynical, depraved, morally bankrupt woman who can't even call herself a feminist. Like, why is that this moment?
Well, I mean, I think there are a lot of reasons. I mean, mainly it's just an explosive moment in terms of female voices, female comedy voices on television and elsewhere. And one of the cathartic things that people do in comedy is talk about taboo subjects. And there are certainly plenty of male comics who talk about sexuality and sex as part of this cathartic comic subject. Mm-hmm. It is a funny thing because sometimes when there are in the review, I call this an embarrassment of bitches, where basically people feel overwhelmed by the amount of shows like this, and then it becomes hard to distinguish them and it's easy to shrug them off. But I think it's important to look at each show in its own light and not take it as just sort of part of a set of cards. This show is a pretty specific show. And I'm trying, you know, at one point when I was writing about it, I was thinking that I think I in the review did compare it to Curb Your Enthusiasm, which is a very odd comparison, I realize. But part of it has to do with the fact that the main character has problems that make her deeply agitating, but by deep in the show, you start to understand that her rudeness is actually has something bigger to say about the way that people function in the world. And it's the reason that I don't feel like it is some sort of purely nihilistic show that people are watching for dark kicks.
Yeah, it also helps that her rudeness is funny. It reminded me in that way of It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, which I love, even though those people are true dirt bags beyond flea bags. But there is, like, you still laugh at all the gross things that they
do. Yeah, and I actually think it's a great comparison because the thing about Always Sunny that I always find fascinating is I think if people watch two episodes, they think that is a cynical show about a bunch of jerks. But if you watch 20 episodes, you start to understand that the show is actually...
broken people.
Yeah. And it's actually like even the worst of those people, it has a strange understanding of the way in which their own delusional view of things is hurting them as well as others. And there is this real pathos to it. It's not a mean show. It's not a bully show. There's different kinds of comedy that take different approaches to this. But I do think that there's something to that. The other thing I have to say about Fleabag, though, is that she's not wrong about a lot of things. Like, you know, part of the struggle is almost like she has a superpower for seeing certain kinds of masculine condescension and phoniness, and she just can't abide them. Like, she cannot be tolerant of them. And so it's small things like she hooks up with this super beautiful man who's talking to her in this really vapid way that is hysterical, and she has to tolerate it in the conversation, but she keeps turning toward the camera and just making kind of Jim from The Office facial expressions at us, and it's just a great scene. But I also, there's this amazing moment, she has this sort of goody good boyfriend who is
Harry.
Yeah, who's in certain superficial ways wonderful, and her sister says to her, I don't understand, like, why you're ruining this. He has always treated you really well. And then there's this little moment where she turns to the camera and she said, but he also said things like, and there's this little flashback, just a shot of him saying something. It's not the end of the world, but he's basically going, you're not like other girls. You can really understand things I say. And it's basically, it's just garden variety condescension, and she's like the princess and the pea with certain kinds of
banality, like boyfriend chatter.
Right. And also just like condescension and things like that. Like, she so can't tolerate them that she has this very cruel approach to the whole thing. But at the same time, it's not as though she is not correct about that. Like, him saying that actually is a meaningful thing. It is this weird red flag about him. But she can't explain that to anybody because it just makes her sound like an intolerant jerk, which, you know, she can be. It's complicated.
Well, that's the question the show doesn't answer. It is very tightly structured, and it does answer one big question by the end. But the question it doesn't answer is, why is she like this? Is she like this because she's lost her friend and her mother, and this is just a particular moment in her life? Is she like this because she's somehow fundamentally like this? Or is she like this because the world is the way it is and her reaction is completely, you know, appropriate?
I don't want to get into details about the show, but I mean, I feel like that is answered in the show. Like, I feel like we do understand actually what she's been struggling with while we're watching her. One thing that I did find interesting within the context of the show and her behavior is that she has a brother-in-law who acts very much like her. He makes inappropriate sexual jokes. He gets drunk all the time. He parties. And one of the things that she's very critical of him, and she's like, he's a jerk. And one of the things that seems to drive her crazy is the fact that people react slightly differently to his behavior. He seems to have a safety in being a kind of funny, dirty male ne'er-do-well that people just shrug off the stuff he does. Whereas for her, it feels to her like there are more repercussions. Maybe that's unfair of her, but it's just kind of an interesting thing within the context of the show, is seeing the question of sort of who gets to act out. And part of that doesn't even have to do with him being a man and her being a woman. It has to do with him being married.
Right.
And
well, he's also portrayed as quite boorish. You don't get his inner monologue in the way you get it with her, right? So maybe he does have this really sharp way of seeing the world, but you don't get it. You just get the blunt behavior that it's kind of terrible.
I think everybody, maybe I just like that actor or something. I describe, I mean, he's a jerk and he acts in many jerky ways, but he's no more than a jerk than her, and he's also quite smart and funny. Like, he says funny things. I don't know. This is a separate part.
I didn't love him, but... Yeah.
Okay, do we want to talk about the sex in the show?
Sure.
Yeah.
The show's really dirty. It has hilarious sex scenes.
The sex scenes are fantastically
well filmed. They often sort of linger on her facial expression. And a lot of the show is actually about her detachment from sex, which on the one hand seems enormously unhealthy and messed up. And on the other hand is a self-protective thing on her part. But she is obsessed with sex. There's that great moment that she lists all the porn that she's looking at. like this insane level of things. So she's almost like a sociologist who's fascinated with sex as an activity, but doesn't in actuality lose herself in it. I mean, she's using it in a self-punishing way.
Well, she also talks about how she loves everything that leads up to sex. She loves the moment when you know someone wants to sleep with you. She loves sort of the dance that goes into it. But then when it actually happens, she's like, eh, it's fine.
And also, like, she just finds hilarious the awkwardness, the physical, like, grossness to her of it. But it's true. She flirts with everyone. There's a moment that she looks at a dog as she's walking by.
Yeah, that's so great.
And then she's like, wait. She actually has to think for a moment. She's like, what am I doing? Like, she so compulsively crosses boundaries and, like, looks at strange men. And it's almost like it's a weird video game. It's kind of like a Pokemon kind of wandering around the city, testing her own power all the time. But again, she doesn't do it in a way that is a really organically sexual way. It's just it is a compulsion on her part.
Yeah, it's like performative, too. Like, she's performing sex all the time. And she has great metaphors. Like, I think one time she describes having sex with one guy as like having sex with a protractor.
I'd forgotten that one.
All right. Well, we all recommend it highly.
Yes. It's one of the best shows that I've seen recently. It's great.
Excellent. Well, Emily, thank you for coming on to talk to us about it. You should all read Emily's review in The New Yorker and watch Fleabag.
Thank you.
All right. Let's move on to recommendations. But before that, let's hear from our final sponsor. Okay. Recommendations. Noreen, Lonely Noreen, it's just me and you. What do you have for us?
I'm going to do two. I won in honor of June. Pour one out for June. So the first one is a movie that I watched on Netflix. It's streaming. It's called An Unmarried Woman. And it's a 70s movie starring Jill Clyburn. It tells the story of a woman who is in a happy marriage. And her husband leaves her for a younger woman. And suddenly she's thrust into the world alone and figuring out how to navigate that. Which sounds not that fun, but it is. It's not fun exactly, but it's fascinating. It's a real time capsule of 70s New York that also feels pretty fresh. And she is sustained by her friendships and she enters into a romance that is satisfying in unexpected ways. So have you seen it?
Yeah. And you know, what's so interesting about what you just said, I never thought of it this way, is like that was a trope of 70s movie is a sort of tentatively venturing out as a woman alone. It's like a kind of full circle back to Fleabag where it's like, ugh, it's just like, that's all we ever do. You know, it's like, that's what you are as like a woman alone in the big city. But there was a moment when that was like a kind of scary and adventurous thing to be, you know?
Yeah. And she, my favorite part of the movie is actually she has this group that it eventually emerges was a friendship that started out of a consciousness raising circle, which is kind of a, you know, time capsule. But those women allow themselves to be sad about being alone, which you don't see you see kind of the rom-com fake version of that, but they really talk about their fears. And I thought that was great. And then the second thing that I'm going to recommend is an article in GQ by Michael. I can never pronounce this. Is it Chabon? Michael Chabon? Michael Chabon. It's called My Son, the Prince of Fashion. And the writer, who is a well-known novelist, takes his very young son to Paris for Fashion Week to report on it for GQ. And it is just really tender. And he is talking about how, you know, his son is precociously into fashion and into streetwear, and the father hasn't gotten it until now. But now he sees his son among his people, and he gets it. He gets the creativity. He gets the feeling of being recognized. And it was just really tender and well done.
Oh, I didn't see that. That sounds great.
It is great.
Okay, so my recommendation this week is Nutshell, the Ian McEwan novel, which I am just loving. It's such a clever, excellent novel. It's told from the point of view of a fetus. It's like the fetus as Hamlet and the fetus's mother as having an affair with the uncle. That's not giving too much away. Like, you figure that out within three pages. But it's this insanely precocious fetus. And it is just so clever and funny and sustains itself. And it's like my salvation this week. I really love this novel.
I'm interested that it's good. I heard that premise and I was like, ooh.
I know. Maybe it not. Bananas. Sounds completely ridiculous and bananas. And I will say it's like a one trick novel. Like, that is the trick. But you're just like in the voice of this fetus who knows absolutely nothing and everything at the same time. And it's not a very long novel. Like, he's not asking you to sustain this infinitely, but it's just really, really great.
That's awesome.
I like it a lot more than I expected to. I know what you mean.
Cool.
Okay, for our non-Slate Plus listeners, that is our show today. Thanks to our producer, Verilyn Williams, the executive producer of Slate Podcast, Steve Lichtai, and Andy Bowers, who is the chief content officer of the Panoply Network, and our wonderful intern, Daniel Schrader. The XX Gabfest is part of the Panoply Network. Check out the entire roster at itunes.com/panoply. Our show page for more information about the show is slate.com/xx. Facebook is facebook.com/XXGabFest. Thank you for all your comments last week about our show on diversity. I would say the comments were mixed, but we appreciate them all. Same for email, XXGabFest@slate.com, or you can subscribe to us on iTunes or any place else where you get your podcasts and leave comments so other people can find out about the show. And our Twitter, XXGabFest.
Wait, I don't think I follow us. I gotta follow us.
All of you should follow us, including you, Noreen Malone.
Doing it right now. Right now.
Do it right now. Okay, good job. All right, well, that's all for today. For Noreen Malone, I'm Hannah Rosen. We will talk to you in 2 weeks. I tried to